It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
We tackle a lot of interesting issues on Farm to Table Talk, and one that's a really tricky issue that's on most people's mind, at least some of the time, and it should be on all of our minds, is how are we going to feed the world? Now, I know some people listening to this are just wondering either what they're going to have for lunch today or how they're going to feed their family, and then they maybe wonder about the community. But trying to get your arms around the world is a pretty ambitious undertaking, and it requires looking at a lot of angles. Well, my guest today is kind of led an effort to help us through that process because she's co-authoring a book called How to Feed the World. She is a former guest of ours on Farm to Table Talk, and she's at Purdue University in the communications doctoral program. And I want to welcome Jessica Eyes. Jessica, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Jessica, I can't imagine that you've got a lot of time on your hands. I mean, you're busy, you're working on a doctoral program, but you've blogged, you've written other books, you've talked about the communications challenges that agriculture has. What led you to decide to tackle this sort of thing, getting your arms around how are we going to feed the world?
Well, this idea started about 2 years ago when I was the director of communications for the Department of Agricultural Economics at Purdue University. And I was looking around and I saw how much incredible knowledge there was around me and these individuals in the College of Agriculture. And so I thought, how can we get this information out in a broader way? How can we connect to these issues together, connect to this expertise? And that was, from there, the idea of the book, How to Feed the World, was born, which I actually was the editor of. So I invited co-editor with Dr. Ken Foster, and I invited these academics to contribute to it. So it's actually quite a broad effort.
Now, are all your contributors at Purdue University?
Everyone but one is from Purdue, and there are 17 of us total. So 16 of the 17 are from Purdue.
Well, this says a couple things. I mean, people might be surprised that you can find experts in all of these areas at one university, but Purdue is a great university. It's a land-grant university, and in my experience, Purdue has had a bigger picture focus over the years than the average land-grant university in agriculture. I've never known quite why. I mean, it did produce Earl Butts years and years ago, but perhaps it was because there were so many commodities that were generic kind of commodities that were affected by world trade, world issues, political processes. But it's always in the forefront of looking at broader issues than kind of the more simple, just solve this or figure out how we control this disease or something like that. They have all of those issues, but it seemed like there's a tradition of Purdue literally looking at the big picture of world agriculture.
I think that, at least from my time in the College of Agriculture, that we take the idea of extension very seriously, outreach and extension. And I think that perhaps in some other places it might just be a lip service, but it really is a way of life, I would say, here at Purdue.
Well, and then over the years, there have been many people from Purdue that have gone on and been in government policy work, too, that have taken a stint in the government, moved to Washington for a while or to Indianapolis, and so there is that tradition that's very impressive. Mm-hmm. So you have the talent, you have the expertise, you have the people that are passionate about their individual area of concern when it comes to feeding the world. I want to get a little bit more back into what got you excited about it, though, because when you look at this broad picture, did it seem to you that the story wasn't getting out there, that people are heading down, I don't know, down a dead-end streets and accusing one problem or another, or trying to be too simplistic in looking at the world food situation and food insecurity and all these issues?
I felt very much, and I still feel, that we are often missing the forest for the trees. We become quite myopic in our focus on one issue or another, and we really fail to see what matters the most. And we also miss the context. I think we look at an issue in isolation, and we don't see how connected it is to the broader picture. And then another thing that I think is quite sad in many ways is that a lot of these issues that matter so much to food security don't get front page attention because they're not exciting or they're not timely in the sense that, you know, they're pressing every single day. They're not pressing, you know, once. They're not an event that arises, but something like water security, that matters every single day. And how do we get people passionately motivated around water security in the same way that we have people passionately motivated about GMOs?
Well, that's right. And you can take so many different issues, like the use of pesticides, whether the products are produced locally or not. You know, there are so many of these that people can kind of get excited about or enthused about. And I suppose we shouldn't discourage that. I mean, it's good for people to be passionate about one element or another, because how do you get your arms around this whole spectrum of the world? And this gets back to the idea that you wanted to put this book together, and then you had to go to the experts, the specialists that were, for the most part, there on the campus, and get them committed. So what is it? You said 17 or 18 different?
There are 17 of us total working on this project, and Roger, it was quite an undertaking.
I can't imagine that, Jessica. So what do you have to do? Try to get on their calendar for 17 different people to come in and pitch your idea and say, would you be willing to contribute?
I showed up in a lot of people's doorways, and I had to be very persistent. But I think this is a testament to the people who contributed to this, is that they had really no incentive to do this. I mean, there was no funding behind this. No one's research was getting funded. And this isn't the kind of typical metric that matters to an academic in terms, it's not a journal article. You know, it doesn't carry a lot of weight on an academic CV. But the fact that they gave us their time and contributed to this effort, I think, stands to their commitment and their belief in how important it is to share these issues to the world in a more accessible way.
Well, don't sell yourself short either, because I assume this isn't, you're not like Dan Brown and get several $1 million advance from a publisher to put this put this together.
I think I did this. I think it probably reveals something of my idealism. And this was definitely a project of passion for me. And yes, there were definitely moments where I thought to myself, why am I doing this?
So
juggling a million emails and trying to get people to, you know, it's past the deadline, and I'm trying to persuade people to please turn in your chapter.
Well, I can just imagine that if you had 17 people, first of all, try to even get to them all in the first place, get them all to agree, and then get them on track. I won't ask you to name names, but no doubt there were some that were stragglers and had either good reasons or they just tend to procrastinate. Things didn't get in on schedule. So it sounds like a huge undertaking. I mean, once you get the commitment is to keep everybody moving towards that common goal.
It was one of the more challenging things that I've done in my professional life, and it really, I think it took a lot of grit and fortitude. One of the things that made this project different is that it's not a normal project, because it's an edited volume that is intended to be accessible. And that kind of breaks the mold, because most edited volumes are academic. And so trying to do something different on top of all of this was a challenge. But I don't know, I can be like a dog with a bone. If I think something's worth it, and I think it matters, and I think it has the potential for impact, I will just hold on to it and just fight till we finish.
Well, Jessica, I'm sure that tenacity paid off. But then when somebody starts giving their work back to you, there's got to, and you're playing the job of editor, then I would imagine you really have to be beyond tenacious. You got to be diplomatic, because you're going to have somebody giving you 2 pages and somebody giving you 75 pages and people that no doubt are very proud of what they've done and are not going to take kindly to being edited. Then I think you really have to have put on your State Department hat to be able to marching around trying to keep everybody happy and still get the modifications you need in the book.
Oh, no question. This is the single most diplomatic endeavor that I've embarked upon in my life.
Well, you produce this. You know, this baby's been born. And and I would suspect there's a certain amount of pride among your team to feel associated with a project which is kind of a labor of love, but a labor of their own passions for the area that they addressed. And now they got it. It's a book. And people can...
I think that when they got the book, when they received it and they actually held it in their hands, I think that was the moment that felt really real to all of us.
And did you have the art and the layout? And was that all done locally with Purdue contacts? Or was it, how did you do that? Those things?
We worked with our publisher, Island Press, and they created this beautiful cover that we have. And they did, I think, a remarkable job with the layouts and the formatting. I think that it's very beautifully done, and we have them to thank for that.
Well, I want to talk about the book now, but let's remind everybody the title of the book and where they could look for it as we get into it. So the book is called How to Feed the World.
How to Feed the World.
Mm-hmm. And can they find it? Where did they find it?
They can find it on Amazon. Mm-hmm. It's also available on our publisher's website, and our publisher is Island Press.
So you have in this book chapters on all the key components. I mean, one of them starts off with just sheer population effort. Now, I wouldn't think that that's necessarily done by somebody in the School of Agriculture. Perhaps it was, but... when you're getting your arms around kind of the size of the world and the food demands to produce for the world, where was that expertise coming from? What was the specialty in campus that helped pull that part together?
So that actually came from the Department of Agricultural Economics, from our resident population expert, Dr. Brigida Waldorf.
And you know, the numbers there are staggering. I mean, people have gotten numb to them, I think, almost, because what we are approaching now, everybody talks about, was it 9 billion? What number are we thinking of?
It's larger now. So it is 10 billion now is what is expected by 2050.
So there's a huge population. And in this chapter, does she address the fact that... some places that have been having 6 children, other places having 1 child, and if the people in the countries that are having 6 children, if they were more prosperous, they tend to have fewer children than the large numbers. And does she deal with those kind of dynamics looking around the world?
She does. Mm-hmm. She absolutely does. She gets into these nuances of population that I think many of us overlook or aren't aware of. For instance, I think that a lot of people envision that population will just continue to grow and grow and grow and grow, but actually it does stabilize at a certain point when a country reaches a certain socioeconomic level. And so you see population growth occurring in waves and different rates in different countries. And she explains that, I think, in a really, really well done way in her chapter.
I'm reading Sapiens right now, and they talk about that tendency of people tending to assume that countries that have large population or large family size will always have large family sizes, and they find the more secure they get and the less they have to worry about food and other necessities, that the size of the family does go down. But even with that, there's going to be a lot of mouths to feed. And the other basic then is if the land itself, we're probably farming most of the land that can be farmed in the world, I would guess. Are we not?
Well, that is actually addressed by Dr. Otto Doering and Anne Sorensen in our third chapter, which is called The Land That Shapes and Sustains Us. And they really get into land use in that chapter. And there are still places that could be farmed. But of course, a lot of that requires planning and thoughtful consideration. And they get into a lot of details that I think a lot of us don't consider or think about when we reflect on land.
Well, then erosion, too, I imagine, is addressed. I mean, how much land is being blown or washed away or even land that maybe shouldn't be cultivated or cultivated in the same way. And did they address those issues, too, minimum tillage and all those things that can be done?
They did, and, interestingly, actually some of that ties into the chapter that follows that, which is written by Dr. Jeff Dukes and Thomas Hurdle, which is called Our Changing Climate. And, we are facing a changing climate, and that will have ramifications for what lands we use to farm different crops. And so this is one of the things that I love so much about this book, is because these issues are interrelated in ways that many of us don't think about. And in creating this book where we tie together these challenges in one place, I feel like it highlights in a unique way how something like land use is also influenced by something like climate change.
Now the authors, they accept the fact that there is climate change and that humans are impacting it?
The scientific body, the general consensus of the scientific corpus, I would say, does except that climate change is happening and that it's caused by humans. But I do think that even people who disagree with the cause of climate change still accept that the climate is changing, and I think that chapter would be valuable.
But the authors start off with that point of view, that they accept the view that there is climate change and humans are probably affecting
mm-hmm.
it.
Yeah.
And so with that, do they look at how that will shift growing regions of the country?
Yeah.
I mean, there's some
mm-hmm.
talk that, like Manitoba is going to be the new Iowa or something like that. There's certain shifts that I've heard of that you could really apply around the world. Some areas that have been great for a certain crop might find that they're only good for wheat, and some others will be more favored than they are currently.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and they do talk about that. And in one of the examples I think they used is actually a local farmer here in Indiana who's had to change the spot where he grows his tomatoes mm-hmm. because the climate has changed sufficiently that the area in which he grew it before doesn't work. So he's had to shift it to a new spot.
Technology's got to play a big role in this,
mm-hmm.
and how do you address the needs for technology and what the potential is for applying technology for feeding the world?
Well, Dr. Yuris Baldus, who wrote Chapter 5, discusses technology in the chapter called The Technology Ticket, and in that chapter he discusses the importance of technology in helping us to overcome the challenges that we do face and we will face with a growing population and a changing climate.
Does he address the controversy about GMOs?
He touches upon it, but he doesn't go into it in too much depth. I would say that the idea of like social controversy and communication gets covered later in chapters 10 and 11. Chapter 10 is called Social License to Operate by Dr. Nicole Widmar. And that chapter addresses how we as human beings allow and disallow things to happen in our societies. And then chapter 11, which I wrote, which is called The Information Hinge, is on communication itself and how the flow of information that we receive is actually what informs us to allow or disallow things to happen. So it's that communication and the flow of information that really is what will motivate us to revoke or provide the social license to operate that Dr. Widmar talks about in her chapter.
Well, expand on that a little bit. It does make sense that the information that we're consuming is going to have an impact on our attitudes, which will have an impact on policies, which, but that begs the problem of the day, doesn't it? That people are increasingly choosing certain social media to be their only source of information, and whatever their biases might be, one way or the other, they just get reinforced because they can do a Google search that just keeps taking them back to whatever they're inclined to want to consume in news. I mean, how do you get this information out when so much of the world seems to be, you know, in that pattern?
So that actually is something that I directly address in that chapter, the echo chamber effect. And it is a problem, and it is something that we need to think about. And I really believe, in the chapter I write out several strategies that we can individually implement to try to prevent ourselves from falling into what I would call an information bubble and to become savvier consumers of information.
Mm-hmm. I mean, do you have some examples of
sure.
some things you're doing in communications that you feel good, that it's kind of connecting in the direction that you hope to?
Are you asking if I have specific examples of communication efforts or do I have specific tips for people?
Both, now that you say it that way.
Well, one example is this book.
Obviously, yeah.
This is a massive communication effort that we created to really try and provide an unbiased, accessible source of information for people. That was a major, major effort. And when it comes to tips, I do have a few, and I'll just list, I usually have six in total, but I'll just list a couple. One of them is to be more discerning about your source of information. So when you read something, look for the source and then think critically about the source. So, for instance, if the source is a company, what is their motivation? And generally the motivation is to sell a product. That doesn't mean that their information is wrong, but you do need to take into consideration that if somebody's sending this message to you and their motivation is to sell a product, are they giving you the full story?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that goes for any item of information you're consuming. A second thing that I like to talk about is, you know, we really listen to our friends and family. Those are our main influencers. And anecdotal evidence can be really interesting and really engaging. But as humans, we're fallible, and our anecdotal information is not always accurate. And so I encourage people, you know, if one of your friends or family tells you a story, doesn't mean you shouldn't believe it. But you should also think, you know, one story does not a trend make. So enjoy the stories that your friends and family tell you, but take it also with a grain of salt that might have been an isolated experience and maybe you want to do a little more research into the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
A third thing that I mention is to take into consideration if you have a strong emotional response to something. So if something invokes a very powerful emotional response in you, the chances are whoever was manipulating that piece of information was doing it on purpose so you would have that emotional response, so you would do something, whether that be to donate money or to buy a product or to get outraged or to sign a petition. Just be thoughtful about the fact that when you respond emotionally, it's generally because someone was hoping you would.
Yeah, and so it's a little bit of skepticism.
I think a healthy degree of skepticism is important, actually.
And challenge and know what the facts are.
Mm-hmm. It's hard because we want to just trust that the information that we're getting is reliable, and we're busy and we have things to do, and when we get home at the end of the day, the last thing we want to do is be critical of every single piece of information we consume. But that's the environment we live in right now.
You know, Jessica, it's kind of a different pattern on the different foods too, because if you grow soybeans in Indiana and you're selling it to Archer Daniels Midland or somebody like that, and it gets made into another product either for human consumption or animal feed, exported to China, and we're going to talk about China, I think, here in a minute or two as well. That's different than if you go to the West Lafayette Farmers Market in the summer and you can actually see the farmer that grew this product, and you can kind of look him in the eye and ask him questions about how he produces things. And I mean, to many people, they're not going to go that far, but some do, and they want to be able to really be reassured. It's not like they know for sure what the right answer is, but they can tell if they're getting it straight, and they can think if they look somebody in the eye that they're getting the straight thing, when otherwise they think it's just propaganda, just sales promotion. I don't know if I worded that into a question or not, but I'm
well, actually, it's interesting that you mention this, because in most of these chapters, all of the authors, we try to, and I encourage them to lead with a personal anecdote, so something that is really relatable to the readers. In my chapter, I actually led with an anecdote that pertains directly to that, and it was about my grandma, my grandma Eileen, who was born in South Dakota. And she was not a farmer, and her family were not farmers. But back then, in the 1920s, half of the U.S. population worked in agriculture, and she was in South Dakota. So she definitely knew farmers personally on a face-to-face basis, and she interacted with them, and she went to school with them, she went to church with them. You know, agriculture was so much more, it was part of the fabric of life for so many people, even if you weren't a farmer. And today that's very different. Less than 2% of the population works in agriculture. There's a much greater distance. People don't have that face-to-face interaction. So yes, it's a challenge. It's definitely something to think about and to reflect on and to be cognizant of.
Well, then the challenge to people telling the story varies depending on, I mean, where they're coming from. I mean, you know, again, if you're going to be advising the farm community that is exporting soybeans, that's probably trickier to find the right way to communicate or the right platforms to communicate, because they're not going to be standing with their soybeans in a stand at a farmer's market or necessarily have it show up on a menu at a restaurant saying, oh, well, this came from Jessica's soybean farm. You know, you never see that. So it changes. The challenge changes.
It does, and it is a challenge, and I'm not going to deny that it isn't a tough one. But I do think that the biggest mistake that can be made and has been made many times is to remain silent. And to think, oh, I don't really know what to say. I don't want to say anything. If I say anything, they're just going to attack me. And then not saying anything at all. And the problem with that today is that when you remain silent, people assume that you're silent because you have something to hide. That is probably not the case. In most cases, people aren't silent because they have something to hide. But that is the assumption of the general consumer of information.
You know, I have to tell a story now, because I remember years ago when I was getting started and after college, I helped pork producers that raise pigs go into supermarkets in cities and other states and pass out samples of pork on a toothpick. And consumers will say, well, I know what pork tastes like, or I know what ham tastes like. I know what a pork chop tastes like. And here there was a farmer or a farm couple that were standing there. But I remember seeing those conversations take place, which don't anymore. I don't know if you can, as many consumers as there are, but don't happen very often. But those are some of the best I've ever seen, because they'd ask, well, you know, we hear you, you know, this is how you raise your pigs, and this is what you feed them, and what about these antibiotics and things like that? And that worked well. Again, it was almost like a farmer's market, except in cooperating supermarkets. There in Indiana, Marsh Supermarkets let that happen quite a bit at one time. But there's very little of that anymore. Maybe it's almost impossible to get that level of trust reestablished.
So I don't think it, okay, well, this is me revealing myself as an idealist. I don't think it's impossible. I just think that I think more as a society, we need to take a hard look in the mirror, and we need to think about if we're interested in continuing to be divisive or if we're interested in trying to be more collaborative.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's more of a general mindset, and it's being all of us need to stop seeing each other as the other, as so different, as the enemy, or as someone who has less in common with us than they have more in common. I think we each need to, and I think this is more of like a collective, I don't know, dance that we seem to be in this sort of unfortunate place as a nation. And
well, we are, but again, with books like yours and encouraging people to step up and ask tough questions, and including the people that have stories to tell, to not be silent and not, but to step out there. These are all important steps. Now, we're not going to be able to cover the entire book, but I do want to come back now to international, because we've implied a lot of what we're talking about is what can be applied locally, and people, many of our listeners, not all of them, are in the United States. But when you look at international, you look at trade issues. I mean, we're at a time in the country and in the world where trade wars are being talked about. And with that, there are going to be tariffs and duties. And how do you get your arms around the importance of global agriculture and the interrelationship?
I would definitely encourage people to read our chapter on trade. By Dr. Tom Hertel, and it's called, it is the seventh chapter in the book, and it's called Tangled Trade. And he does a spectacular job of summarizing what is an incredibly complex issue. It is not an easy issue, and it's not an issue that can be summarized in a soundbite. Because like Dr. Hertel writes in his chapter, there are always going to be winners and losers in trade. Always. And so no matter what policy you come up with, someone's going to win and someone's going to lose, even within your own country. And he also explains what does it mean to not have open trade around food, and what does it mean to have open trade around food. And I'm not even going to try to summarize what he wrote, but I really strongly encourage people to take a look at Chapter 7, Tangled Trade, by Dr. Hertel.
Well, I wonder, as we're talking about this, if this wouldn't be a great book for book clubs. It's not what all of them take on. I don't know whether we're going to get Oprah to recommend it or not, but I could see each of these chapters that you can have people have some really interesting conversations, and if people try to at least invest in understanding these broader issues of how to feed the world and all of the issues involved, that'd be great for people to make that kind of a commitment and see the effort that you and your 17 co-authors put into getting this story out here. One thing I want to ask you is that if somebody goes through reading the book, maybe they don't have it at a book club, but they've read the book and they've thought about it, and try to use some of that information. I mean, you know, I think it's enough to just have more knowledge. And then I always had the feeling that you somehow use it, even if you don't realize you're using it when you're expanding your knowledge, and this will certainly help you. But after you've gone through this exercise, you know, what's your impression? I mean, you've written some of this, you've edited all of this, you've pulled people together, you've looked at it, you've considered it. What do you think are some of the biggest challenges facing and feeding the world?
So the last, in our conclusion, we issue a call to action, and we state basically that everyone has something to offer, be you young or old, in agriculture or not in agriculture. Every human being on this planet has something, some gift, some talent, some unique perspective that they can use to contribute to this effort. And there's no way that I can say what that is for each individual. And that's why I think reading this book would be so helpful, because in reading it, you get the big picture and you see this glimpse into the issues, and you'll know when you're reading it, when you're going through it, something, some little piece will be illuminated to you, and you might think, this is how I can help. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to be different for each person.
Well, it's an interesting perspective because, again, you've got a huge book. You've got all of these experts that have written the book. There's broad areas, but I like that approach. I mean, there's a spot for everyone to be more aware and to see an opportunity to come up to speak out about maybe constructive use of new technologies and what it might mean, a better attitude about trade, importance about water issues and how to keep good, clean water. One thing we didn't even talk about is avoiding waste, minimizing the waste that we're throwing away food. We didn't talk much about health issues, which are addressed too. But there are things that people reading or hearing or listening, in some way they're going to say, okay, I see that. There's maybe I can speak up rather than just be quiet when a debate is going one way or the other. Speak up, write a letter to the editor, write a blog, talk to your congressman, and ultimately make informed decisions when you're shopping. You know, think about where your food comes from, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Everything you just listed.
And, you know, to me, the other thing I was thinking about is that when I go out and get in the car after I have a conversation like this, before you get to almost any destination, people have choices to make as to whether or not they're going to let somebody turn into the road in front of them. You know, you leave a gap or don't, and people give you a little nod and say, oh, thank you for letting me drive my car in, which might seem a reach, but it just, to me, it's like we probably have 1,000 opportunities a day to, in some small way, do the right thing. So it just makes sense that, like, our most important activity that a lot of us look forward to too much, eating, that we have choices to make and a chance to say, look, I have a right to have my voice be heard on this. I have an opinion. I have questions. I'm skeptical.
Even a decision as small as, am I going to finish the food on my plate? Am I going to put my leftovers in the refrigerator and eat them tomorrow? Every little decision matters. If we see our individual efforts as futile because we're just one person in a world of billions, then no, we won't be able to make change. But if we all take individual ownership of our actions, that's really the first step.
Well, I'll tell you what. I think that Jessica Ives, that we have and a little inspiration from you, based at Purdue University. You're having something to do with getting a book out that should make us all think, and I hope people will check out How to Feed the World. You're doing great work, Jessica. Keep up the good work, because there's a lot to do yet.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for being on Farm to Table Talk.
It's always a pleasure.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.